your Border Use Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today we will continue listening to Tangent's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello, and once again, welcome to the program. Phil, our station manager, regularly checks the statistics for the station's broadcasts, and I understand that quite a few people in America, Canada, Ireland, and other overseas countries are downloading the podcasts to this program. I've also had positive feedback from some of you from overseas. Thank you all so much for listening. You make the program truly worthwhile, and I hope it's benefiting you in the best way possible. It's difficult for me to say how much I appreciate your participation, but please know that I do, a lot. For those new to the program, we're going through an ancient Buddhist text called A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life by the Indian master Shantideva. We're nearing the end of the text and are on chapter 8, the chapter on meditation. However, Shantideva doesn't go through the stages of meditation or instructions how to meditate. Instead, he describes how to meditate on bodhicitta, the mind that wishes to attain full enlightenment to benefit all living beings everywhere. Although a standard way of meditating to develop the mind of bodhicitta involves seeing all beings as one's mother and nurturing the intention to repay their kindness in the best way possible, that is, to become enlightened, Shantideva takes another tack, teaching us first to equalize ourselves with others and then to exchange our usual self-cherishing attitude for the attitude that always cherishes others more. He leads us ultimately to the state where our only concern is for the well-being, temporal and ultimate, of all beings everywhere. Of course, that means that in the process, we will solve all our own problems as well. Let's now do a thought experiment. Imagine yourself as not yet born, but seeing your father's sperm and your mother's ovum coming together to form what will eventually be the body you will take. At this stage, your consciousness enters into the combination sperm and egg. But can you say that that combination is you? Can you think, ah, now this is me? When does it become you? It wasn't you when the two were not yet together. And at what stage of the meeting did the combination actually form the being me? And now, if you bring yourself into the present body, can you say that this body is really you? What makes it you or yours? From its side, does the body associate itself as you? What will happen when the consciousness finally leaves the body? Will the body still be you? If some brilliant, mad scientist managed to make the minimum number of bionic parts so that your body could rise again after death and act like a human being, but without your consciousness, would it still be you? Okay, so we may be going off the rails a little bit here, but this thought experiment might help to explain what Shantideva means when he says in verse 111 of this chapter, although the basis is quite impersonal, through constant familiarity, I've come to regard the drops of sperm and blood of others as I. And then asks, well, if we can so strongly associate me with a quite impersonal sperm and ovum of dad and mum, why shouldn't we be able to make the same association with the equally impersonal sperm and ovum of another man and woman? Now remember that Shantideva is forming an argument to explain how and why we can come to regard all beings as precious as ourselves. We can, he says, come to see every other being as me, so that their joy becomes my joy and their pain is just as hurtful to me. But if you don't like that example, he uses another in verse 114, also based on the body. In the same way as the hands and so forth are regarded as limbs of the body, likewise, why are embodied creatures not regarded as limbs of life? Now, normally if something happens to our hand, for instance, our whole body seems to suffer because we strongly identify each limb as crucial to the body. And if one hand is hurt, the other immediately goes to its rescue or to comfort it. If a foot is hurt, both hands rush to soothe it. And so would the head if it could. In the same way, Shantideva asks, why can't we see that all beings are like the limbs of the body of life? And if one is harmed, the others must perforce rush to help it. And so in verse 115 he writes, through acquaintance has the thought of I arisen towards this impersonal body. So in a similar way, why should it not arise towards other living beings? Well, we only think of our body as me because we've been so closely associated with it for so long. Through acquaintance, says Shantideva, with a little understatement. However, as we've seen, in itself it is quite impersonal. Nothing makes it intrinsically me. It's only my mind that grasps it that way. So why can't the mind grasp at others in the same way? Why, when we see another person walking towards us, can't we think, oh, here is me coming towards myself? And then we can say to the other person, oh, hello, me. How am I today? I'm fine, says the other. How am I? Oh, whoops, I've wandered into Monty Python territory here, which I seriously doubt Shantideva intended. But silliness aside, the test he sets us is to train our minds so that others become as valuable and as close to us as we are currently to ourselves. When we can achieve that, then it will be as impossible not to want to help them as it will be to harm them. Pema Chodron, in her commentary, wonders what it would be like if in a family or city, instead of our attitude of me first, we all really regarded others with the understanding that they are just like me and cared for them in that light. Now, this last verse is one onwards from where we got to in our last program. So let's take a pause here to set our motivation as we usually do. If you can, please think that this program and our participation in it will become the cause for the enlightenment of all beings. In particular, may it take us to Buddhahood so that we can help all others not yet enlightened get there. Thank you. And now in his next verse, Shantideva sets up his guard against delusions of pride that may arise when he starts exchanging himself for others. When I work in this way for the sake of others, I should not let conceit or the feeling that I am wonderful arise. It is just like feeding myself. I hope for nothing in return. Now, it's easy to feel that we are some kind of good person when doing a virtuous deed, and we need some recognition. And if we get it, pride easily arises. Shantideva says that when we work for others, we should do it in the same way as we feed ourselves. Giving our body food, we don't expect anything in return. As Pema Chodron in her commentary says, we don't need applause for feeding a starving puppy. It's as natural as feeding ourselves. We don't expect to be congratulated or win a Nobel Peace Prize for our efforts. Shantideva continues, therefore, just as I protect myself from unpleasant things, however slight, in the same way I should habituate myself to have a compassionate and caring mind for others. It is out of his great compassion that the Lord Avalokiteshvara has even blessed his name to dispel the nervousness of being among other people. Avalokiteshvara is the Sanskrit name for the Bodhisattva who has come to be seen as the personification of all the Buddha's compassion. In Tibetan, he's known as Chenrezig. In the Zen and Chinese traditions, the figure is female and called Kuan Yin, or Kuan Am. In fact, the Lotus Sutra describes 33 manifestations of Avalokiteshvara. In his commentary, The Nectar of Manjushri's Speech, on this verse, Kunzang Peldon says this: "The compassionate Lord Avalokita wished to dispel the great dangers and fears of beings in the three realms of samsara, right down to the worries someone might feel when standing in front of a large group of people. Therefore, after he generated bodhicitta, aiming at the attainment of Buddhahood, he blessed his own name by the power of prayer, concentration, and wisdom, and prayed that the mere remembrance of it would protect all beings from their fears." Quoted in the Gandavuya Sutra, he said, "May every fear and danger, such as being burned in a great fire and being carried away by water, be brought to nothing just by the mere remembrance of my name. By recalling my name three times, may everyone be released from fear and anguish when in the midst of many people." So, the next time you have to give a speech before a whole crowd of people, recite the name or mantra of Avalokiteshvara, and your stage fright might well be stilled. The mantra is Om Mani Padme Hum. And if you ever go to Tibet or a Tibetan settlement in India and see people holding rosaries and muttering, almost certainly they will be reciting this mantra over and over again throughout the whole day. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is regarded among Tibetans and many others who follow the Tibetan Buddhist tradition as an emanation of this bodhisattva. To see something extraordinary about the recitation of this mantra, search on YouTube for a video called Buddhist Nun Speaks After 45 Years of Solitary Retreat. It's a clip from the National Geographic video Light at the Edge of the World. The clip is about the visit by the monk Matthew Ricard and Wayne Davis to a Tibetan nun who had lived in solitary retreat for 45 years. Her practice, motivated by bodhicitta, had condensed itself into the recitation of a single mantra. She broke her solitude to speak briefly to her visitors and had this to say to them. And it's a spoiler, so if you prefer to hear it from the clip, turn the volume down. She said that all the monastic study, debate, and so on was wonderful, and she had much respect for it. But all Buddhist practice comes down to the single mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, motivated by and dedicated to the freedom from inner and outer suffering of all sentient beings. It is, she said, the one Dharma that condenses all. As Matthew Ricard translates in the clip, it all boils down to the nature and quality of our mind. All Buddha's teachings were meant to understand the nature of our mind. The main thing is to give away all elaborate practice and remain in the nature of the Buddha mind. Such beautiful words, but much easier said than done. The old nun had been practicing continuously for 45 years to come to this realization. Our practice of at most a few hours a day seems paltry in comparison. But then Shantideva has an answer even for such discouragement. In the next verse he writes, "I should not turn away from what is difficult, for by the power of familiarity I may be made unhappy even when someone whose name once frightened me is not around." We could object that the old nun's practice, although difficult, did not in fact really benefit anyone. How can anyone sitting alone in a hut reciting a mantra endlessly benefit beings? But her real practice was exchanging self for others. She ran away from a life of luxury to transform her mind. So now, if we compare her mind to ours, we will see that our compassion is infantile in comparison. Wherever she goes and whatever she does in future lives will be of enormous benefit to whatever being she comes across. Can we say the same for ourselves? I certainly can't. But by the same dint of practice, I too could transform my mind. Of course, it seems impossible. Closeting oneself away for the rest of one's life and dedicating everything one does to the well-being of all living beings. But in his commentary, His Holiness the Dalai Lama says we should not be discouraged. It's a question of getting used to it through training, he writes. For example, it is possible to become used to a person whose mere name once made one afraid. One can even reach the point where one cannot bear to be separated from that person. Start practicing now for people you like, says Pema Chodron, and soon enough you will be able to move on to the neutral people or those you find only mildly irritating. And she writes, over time, our compassion can expand until we reach the point where grieving for those we dislike and fear doesn't seem so far-fetched. The Dalai Lama was teaching in front of a large audience when he received word that Mao Tse-tung had died. He paused and then started to weep. For most Tibetan people, nobody was more feared than Mao Tse-tung. Yet the Dalai Lama's first reaction was to weep, perhaps in part because of the suffering Mao Tse-tung would go through as a result of his cruelty to the Chinese and Tibetan people. And then Shantideva continues, thus, whoever wishes to quickly afford protection to both himself and other beings should practice that holy secret, the exchanging of self for others. His Holiness calls exchanging self for others the sure method for protecting others as well as oneself. However, he admits that it's difficult, even as a concept, for those with a limited understanding of bodhicitta. And this is why Shantideva calls it a holy secret. Pema Chodron explains further, sometimes the sun is obscured by clouds. It may not even seem to be shining. This, of course, isn't the case. The sun is simply hidden. In the same way, the unobscured nature of the mind is always with us, but it is blocked by self-absorption. It's hidden by opinions, biases, and concepts, and obscured by kleshas. When we reflect on this verse, it's helpful to keep this in mind. The clouds of self-centeredness mysteriously part when we put ourselves in another person's place and imagine what he or she feels. In Tonglen practice, we breathe in what we usually push away and send out what we usually cling to. This dissolves the ego's strategies and reveals the clarity of our mind. It may be a mystery how this simple practice frees us, but it's definitely a mystery worth embracing. Now, the Tonglen she talks about is the practice of breathing in one's own and all other beings' sufferings and breathing out all one's happiness and giving it to others. In English, it's translated as giving and taking, though it's practiced in reverse order, taking and giving. Of course, we naturally want to breathe in happiness and breathe out suffering, and there are meditations to do that. But this particular practice, as Pema Chodron points out, does the opposite of what we normally do, and by dissolving ego strategies, we can accomplish extraordinary compassion and understanding, like that of the old Tibetan nun. But, says Shantideva, the reason that we don't want to perfect practices like Tonglen is our dedicated attachment to me and mine. Because of attachment to my body, even a small object of fear frightens me. So who would not revile as an enemy this body that gives rise to fear? By wishing for a means to remedy the hunger, thirst, and sickness of the body, I might kill birds, fish, and deer, and loiter by the sides of roads to rob others. If for the sake of its profit and comfort, I would kill even my father and mother and steal the property of the Triple Gem, then I would undoubtedly proceed to burn in the flames of the deepest hell. Therefore, what wise man would desire, protect, and venerate this body? Who would not scorn it and regard it as an enemy? Now, it's often said that we hate suffering, but we love the causes of suffering. We love to gain enlightenment, but we dislike the causes for it. This is probably the most difficult cause of all, to give up everything for the sake of all other beings. As Shantideva points out, our strong attachment to our body and its comforts leads us to commit many deeds that might give us immediate satisfaction, but which just put us on the path to greater suffering later on. It's so sensitive, this body of ours. I think, for example, of the times that I've been walking down the street and a dog suddenly barks at me from behind a fence. Immediately, fear grips my belly, even if it's a dog so small it's not even worth thinking about. And this just shows how protective we can be about this body of ours. Even a mouse can make us yelp with fear. When I was staying at the monastery in India, I had a mosquito net to guard against the hordes of mozzies that thrive in the heat there. One night, I was sound asleep under this net when I was woken by something scurrying across my body. I sat bolt upright with a yell, and the small rat that was investigating my bed got such a fright it leapt up and around the side of the mosquito net like one of those motorbikes that whiz around the wall of death at carnivals. When I lifted the net up so the little creature could escape, it ran out of the room as fast as its feet could carry it. And I don't know who got the biggest fright, the rat or myself, but it demonstrates what Shanti Davis says. We are so attached to this body and its safety and comfort, the smallest apparent threat sends us into paroxysms. Of course, when it comes to their taste buds and a sense of sport, hunters and fishermen are very happy to go out and kill animals and sea creatures. In New Zealand, it's almost like a national pastime, not to mention raising animals for slaughter. Just to satisfy our meat lust, we kill billions of animals every year. The website Hoo-Ha estimates that 77 million broiler chickens are killed every year to satisfy the appetites of New Zealanders, although the website does not cite its sources. And another website, ADAPT, that's ADAPTT, estimates that 150 billion animals are slaughtered every year worldwide. The site contains a kill counter showing the number of various animals killed from the moment the site is opened. This site's stats are based on those from the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations for the year 2003. But ADAPT cautions. According to these statistics, about 53 billion land animals are slaughtered annually worldwide. It should be noted that at the time the numbers were compiled, they were the minimum number of animals killed each year. The actual numbers may be significantly greater, insofar as some countries or territories either did not report or deliberately excluded some statistics. Of the more than 200 countries researched, the top three, the United States, China, and Brazil, consume a staggering 46% of these animals as food. The United States alone consumes roughly 20% of all animals slaughtered for food, even though it contains less than 5% of the world's population. It's important to note that since most of the available data are now 8 years old as of 2011, these estimates are extremely conservative. It is now quite likely that in many of the categories noted, the current kill rates are as much as 10% higher than what is indicated here. As for robbers, they may not so much loiter by the roadside these days, but there are plenty of stories of muggings, both of the coarse physical kind and the white-collar crime kind, in the newspapers every day. Shanti Davis says we will kill even our parents and steal from the Triple Gem in our attempts to satisfy the urges of our body. Again, when I was in Mongolia in 1994, the Russians had recently decamped back to their own country, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama was able to visit and give the Kalachakra initiation into a very special tantric practice that he gives from time to time as a blessing for world peace. Part of the initiation is the viewing of a very elaborate mandala that the monks construct laboriously out of colored sand. If you haven't seen one, grab the chance when you can, for they're quite stunningly beautiful. In any case, to view the sand mandala, we had to form a long queue, and just before the mandala, you could make a donation into a plate. While I was there, one enterprising chappie, instead of putting something into the plate, decided to take what he could out of it and make a run for it. Unfortunately for him, others had tried that trick before, and the monks were on the lookout for it. They quickly caught him and dealt with him in a swift but maybe not so monkly way. He left the hall well chastened. But this is the sort of thing Shanti Deva is talking about when he writes about stealing from the Dharma. Monks have to be particularly careful that they don't use for their own personal benefit things that belong to the Sangha community. In Shanti Deva's day, there would have been stewards that looked after the monastery belongings. But if a monk decided to take something for himself without the permission of the steward, he would be guilty of stealing from the Sangha. Of course, the steward himself would have had to be meticulously honest. His Holiness the Dalai Lama says that to sustain this body of ours, we kill other beings, to make it comfortable we steal, and to satisfy its ephemeral desires, we indulge in indiscriminate sexual activity. In short, he writes, because of the importance we attribute to our bodies, we accumulate a lot of negative actions. If we let our bodies do whatever they want, it can only be to our loss and detriment. And Pema Chodron points out that our self-protective tendencies, when we kill, steal, and so on, can be as dangerous as treating ourselves with scorn. Both self-protection and self-loathing are self-centered, and both bring us much harm. So when Shanti Deva talks about regarding the body as an enemy, it's only in the context of its potential to lead us into trouble and our excessive attachment to it. In fact, we have to look after the body carefully, for in the Tibetan teachings, we're given to understand that the human body is the best kind of body to attain enlightenment in. And those who practice the Bodhisattva and Tantric paths have a commitment not to treat their bodies badly. In one of his most famous quotes, His Holiness says, "There's no need for temples, no need for complicated philosophies. Our own brain, our own heart is our temple. Philosophy is kindness." And the Buddha also said that in the whole universe, there's no one more deserving of your love and compassion than you yourself. So we should not regard our body for its own sake with scorn, but respect it as the vehicle which can take us to our highest goals. However, that doesn't mean we give in to its every whim and urge, but take it under control and use it wisely. Pema Chodron goes on to write in her commentary, "The Mahayana teachings say the reason we don't harm others is that we care about them. We don't kill because we cherish the lives of others. We don't steal because we respect their possessions. We don't refrain from negative actions. We also practice loving kindness." And I don't know why she makes the distinction about the Mahayana teachings, because the Theravada teachings hold the same motivations. One of the most widely recited suttas in the Theravadan tradition is the Karaniya Metta Sutta, which I've quoted in the program before. In describing a person skilled in goodness and familiar with the path of peace, the Buddha says, "Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. If we cherish all living beings as a mother protects with her life her only child, we will, of course, avoid harming them. Through respecting their lives, we will not kill them, and through respecting their possessions, we will not steal. And if this sutta is not a full description of loving kindness, what is?" And now it's time to go. Please, as usual, dedicate this program to the enlightenment of all beings, and thank you for joining us today. I hope you'll be inspired to come back next week. Goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful, beneficial, empowering.
Diana.